We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, in a sense, on the grounds and in the hallways of the Air Force Academy. And we do that via a very interesting book called Skies to Conquer, A Year Inside the Air Force Academy. Its author, Diana Jean Shemo, is a journalist who's written for the Baltimore Sun and the New York Times. She's covered all kinds of different issues and topics in many different places. In writing this book, Diana Jean Shemo follows a group of freshmen at the Air Force Academy, all part of the Bulldogs of Squadron 13. And it is a very frank look at the glories and the struggles, the adventures and the misadventures that are part of these students' experience. And we honestly, we see an honest picture of what draws many of them there in the first place, some of the heartbreak and crippling doubt which they sometimes experience, and those who manage to survive the gauntlet, and others who do not, who leave the Air Force Academy for one reason or another. And all of this plays out against the backdrop of some very serious controversy which has plagued the Air Force Academy in recent years. So the book is also about the story of the Air Force Academy trying to rebuild and solidify its own reputation, and in some cases wrestling with very, very difficult issues. The book is published by Wiley. Again, it's called Skies to Conquer, A Year Inside the Air Force Academy. And Diana Jean Shemo, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
I really look forward to this. I'm rather astonished that such a book is possible, that is, for an outsider to be granted this kind of access to students at the Air Force Academy. Can you begin our conversation by explaining how this came to pass?
In 2003, I was sort of detailed to help out on the sexual assault scandals, and so I covered the Air Force Academy as part of my overall brief, which was covering education from 2000 to 2008 for the New York Times. And so I looked at this place that year and was very intrigued by the kinds of cadets that I was meeting. Even the women who were victims of rape, they seemed to be very different from the undergraduates that I met at civilian campuses, and I was intrigued. And the following year, they had the religious scandals, which were commonly called Jesus Gate on the base, and that sort of just got me even more interested. And so a few years after that, I went to the academy and to the Air Force, and I asked for permission to do this kind of a book. I was myself actually a little bit surprised that they granted the access that they did, because I kind of thought they felt very burned by the coverage, not specifically my coverage, but by coverage in general. And so I was a little bit surprised myself, but I think that why they did that is because they themselves felt that they were really trying to right the ship. They were really taking steps to try to prevent these kinds of things from happening again. It's a big place, and the culture runs very, very deep, and that was one of the lessons I found. So it doesn't change overnight. But they felt that they were making enough of an effort that it would be to their benefit to have somebody come in and take a look at the whole picture rather than just the places where they slipped up.
Can you recount for our listeners briefly the two major controversies which you have just mentioned? I'm sure many people have at least some recollection of the first, that is the controversy involving sexual assault and even rape of certain female cadets. Just outline for our listeners just how serious a problem this, in fact, was and what sort of occurred in the wake of that.
Wow, it was a really big issue at the time. At first, just a handful of women came forward and said that they had been raped at the academy. And not just rape, but that I think what made it really sort of shocking for many people was that when they reported the incidents, the chain of command ended up punishing them, the victims, rather than the assailants very often. Sometimes there would be alcohol violations, you know, infractions involved in these incidents. And so the women would be the ones who very often ended up doing tours, as they're called, which is just marching around the terrazzo, the main sort of cadet open area, what would be a quad on a civilian campus, marching around hundreds of times while their assailants would deny the allegations, and then it would become he said, she said, but in the course of reporting the incident, the victim might have admitted to using alcohol. So there was this shock. Anyway, it started with a small group, and eventually the number ballooned until by the end of it, it was more than 60 cadets and former cadets came forward to Senator Wayne Allard, who sits on the Academy's Board of Visitors and is from Colorado, to say that they too had been victims of assault at the Academy. That triggered really a number of investigations, some by the Defense Department itself. The Inspector General of the Air Force looked into it. Congress had ordered the creation of a panel, which was chaired ultimately by Tilly Fowler, and that found that to look into this, and that panel found a very deep culture that didn't quite fully accept women as cadets and that didn't respect women, and so it really triggered a series of changes, and it cost the commandant of cadets and the whole sort of leadership at the academy their jobs.
I wonder if you could mention to our listeners, this is, in the whole scheme of things, is a fairly inconsequential detail, at least on the surface. And yet, especially the way you write about it, it speaks to just what a painful and difficult situation this was. I want you to tell our listeners about a certain sign that was removed from the campus in the wake of this controversy, what prompted the removal of that sign and some of the complicated feelings felt by the cadets after that action was taken.
Yeah, the sign actually read, "Bring Me Men," and it was a line from a poem that was really had nothing to do with men per se, but in the wake of the scandal, it came to be seen as a sign that was saying, in a sense, "Bring me men," parentheses, and not women. Many people read it that way, as a kind of sort of overt sign that the academy was not sort of open, as open to women, and had not quite, you know, adjusted itself to the presence of women, even though they had been attending since 1976, as at the other academies. And so that sign was removed back in 2003, when all of this this scandal broke. And it was replaced by the motto of the academy, which is service before self, excellence in all we do. There's a third part to it that I'm blanking on at this moment, but integrity. I'm going to have to think about it for a second and get it for you. But it was replaced by this this motto, which is a sort of call to honor and integrity. And the other important part of it is that this "Bring Me Men" is the first thing that cadets see when they first arrive. It's at the ramp that they ascend to enter the academy when they first become cadets and turn up for basic training. So it's hugely symbolic. Now, when they first removed that, I think for many people in the country, that was a sign that the academy was okay, going to move in the right direction, and it was sort of taking down these symbols that people saw as, you know, overt signs of bias, in a sense. But within the academy, there were some people who agreed with that. But then there were others, even among the incoming cadets, who felt that the academy had perhaps caved in to outside pressure, and that it was sort of losing sense of its own value and direction in doing so. And they regretted the loss of that sign.
You write at one point, in a culture that venerates tradition, the removal of the sign rankled many. I was so glad that you included an extensive excerpt from this poem from which those words, "Bring Me Men," comes. As you said, it's a poem, "The Coming American," by Samuel Walter Foss. And the excerpt you include in your book includes these words: "Bring me men to match my mountains. Bring me men to match my plains. Men to chart a starry empire. Men to make celestial claims. Bring me men to match my prairies, men to match my inland seas, men to sail beyond my oceans, reaching for the galaxies. These are men to build a nation." Now, I happen to be a man, so maybe I can't claim to be entirely unbiased, but, you know, that's an amazingly wonderful poem, and its sentiments are wonderful. And yet, I can understand how someone might read just the three words, "bring me men," emblazoned on a sign as you enter the Air Force Academy, and be deeply troubled by them. And just the fact that words can be interpreted in such different ways or mean different things to different people really gets at the heart of just how complex some of these problems and issues ultimately are, especially as they play out in real life.
I think actually that was one of the most interesting, you put your finger on something that was one of the most interesting aspects of this whole reporting for the book, which was, in a sense, when I wrote about the issue in 2003, I was, like probably many other Americans, relieved that they had taken down that sign. And when I got there and I, you know, learned about the reactions of the cadets and read the poem in its entirety, like you, I said, well, this is a really very transcendent poem, in a sense. You know, it is talking about grand ambition and sort of the hunger of a new nation to complete itself. And so I thought it has a completely different context, and, you know, it just seemed like actually, you know, the perfect poem to put there. But it may be in its entirety, it would have been. But I suppose those three words, you know, did open it to a lot of misinterpretation. But that was kind of the most important, interesting aspect of the reporting, to see things that looked one way when you're on the outside having completely different aspects when you're on the inside.
So this is one of the controversies that forms the backdrop for your visit to the Air Force Academy, this terrible tragedy, let's call it, infamous tragedy involving sexual assault and rape among cadets, and how the Air Force Academy was striving to do something about that. And then almost immediately in the wake of that came a second controversy, which the ramifications of which were also still playing out as you visited the Air Force Academy several years later. Tell us about this controversy involving religion. I think this had a much lower public profile. I, for one, at least, knew nothing about this until I read your book.
It was about a year after. Some people linked the two scandals, but I actually don't think that they were linked. What happened in 2004 was essentially something that had been a long simmering issue exploded when one alumnus blew the whistle on it. And this was the overt proselytizing that was going on by officers, by faculty, even by upper-class cadets and cadets with each other, by evangelicals. You would find emails that were after official government emails that after the emails were signed, there would be a quote from scripture, which they don't do anymore, but that was what was part of this. There was a special academy showing of the movie The Passion of the Christ, which many people had condemned as anti-Semitic and historically skewed. For 3 days, every cadet in the academy found a flyer for the movie on his or her plate in Mitchell Hall, the dining hall, telling them to attend the screening of the movie and that it was a special academy showing. There were flyers posted on the walls, there were many, many instances where there was a chaplain who had been actually the Air Force Chaplain of the Year that year, who was accused by cadets of having led a prayer meeting and during basic training by telling cadets that they, a worship service by telling cadets that they should go back to their tents and convert their tent mates who were not Christian, or they would burn in the fires of hell. So it was just kind of mixing of religion and the desire to serve country that was shocking to many, many people, myself included, I have to say. And so that was the backdrop for a lot of the changes that were going on. And by the time I got there, the most overt of those things was no longer there. But there were still very deep kind of cultural pressures and presumptions that were of a piece, in a sense, I would say.
Hmm. So for you, granted this this kind of access, and unexpectedly so, as you said, you could not possibly have asked, in a sense, for a better time to observe the Air Force Academy, because not only is this an interesting story, even without all of what you've just recounted, but the fact that the Air Force Academy was in this moment in its history of rebuilding, realignment, reassessment, it made it, in a sense, I should think, the opportunity of a lifetime for a writer like yourself.
It was really interesting that way because, you know, what I found was that even though you saw the leadership trying to make some changes, there was a really interesting culture that came from below. The cadets themselves felt that they were the guardians of that culture. So this was an amazing moment, as you say, where the Academy was, in a sense, trying to reinvent the way that it does things. And the cadets from below, a lot of them were pushing back and saying, hey, this is not, you can't professionalize this training as if it were Lackland Air Force Base. You can't do that. This is not about just training people to do a job. This is about, in a sense, building a brotherhood that's going to last us for the rest of our lives. And this is our brotherhood. You know, not it's not just a job for the next couple of years. So they were very different. You know, you were talking about the poem a moment ago and saying the words, how they look from one person versus another, and how open to interpretation they are. And if you think about it, the Academy is pulling people from virtually every congressional district across the country and has to mold them into something that works and that's cohesive and has a common unifying purpose. And so there are myriad interpretations of everything that happens, and it was a fascinating process to watch. I, at one point, sort of thought of it as almost sort of watching creation, in a sense, because you're watching people's personalities, their egos, being blown apart from the moment they arrive, virtually, and then something else being rebuilt in its place. And so there was sort of change happening on every level from the cadets who are coming in as these high school grads. You know, 4 weeks ago they were high school grads. All of a sudden they're learning to march, and they're being told that everything they think doesn't matter. It's learning how to follow orders now is the name of the game. To the upperclassmen, to the institution itself, to the Air Force. I mean, the Air Force at the time was, you know, on the cusp of this huge change that we're seeing really blossoming now, coming to fruition now, where the role of the manned, the pilot in the cockpit of a manned aircraft is, you know, becoming less and less important to the overall picture. And these are the guys who are sort of the guys and women who are like the glory, you know, the heroes of the Academy are the ones who end up getting slots to fly bombers and fighter planes. And now so much of the job is being taken over by these unmanned drones that even the future that they're walking into is uncertain.
Diana Jean Shemo is the author of this fascinating book, Skies to Conquer, A Year Inside the Air Force Academy. you were surprised by the access that you were granted by the Air Force Academy to follow these cadets. Explain to our listeners exactly what kind of access you were granted, and also maybe the nuts and bolts of how you spent your time when you were, do we call it a campus, on the campus of the Air Force Academy, or the grounds of the Air Force Academy?
Yeah, they call it post or base. They don't really call it a campus. Everything has its own term, so it's post or base. But I had actually originally asked for completely unfettered access. I asked to be allowed to come and go as I needed to, and to observe anything I wanted to, and to be able to do this possibly for 4 years. It was a little uncertain when I set out. I said, you know, if it's really possible, I'd like to maybe follow one class for 4 years. So they left that as an open question in the beginning, as did I. It was more like, I just like to put the question out there to see if you could be amenable to it, because there were two ways I saw of doing it, you know, following the whole, all four classes for 1 year, or one class to do 4 years. So I followed four classes for that first year, not knowing whether I would have a second or third or fourth year with them. They said in response that after 9/11, they could not grant unfettered access because everybody has to be escorted on base. And so what they could do is just have somebody there to take me to wherever I needed to go, and they wouldn't be sitting in on interviews, because I frankly wouldn't have done it if, you know, I had to have somebody sitting in on every interview, because it would be very hard to get any sort of a frank discussion going or build a rapport with somebody over your shoulder. So they had to basically keep me within their eyesight. So they could sort of, sometimes they would be walking down the halls, or they would be in another room, they would be chatting. Occasionally one or two sat in, but it wasn't like there was a... The only time they made it a point to sit in on interviews was when it was not a cadet, but it was an officer, because then the officers themselves have different rules for speaking, you know, to the press. And so they would have somebody sit in if I was interviewing kind of in an office with, say, the chaplains the honor board, things like that. So that was sort of how we negotiated that. And then at the end of the year, they said that they could not support three more years because they were losing three people who were being reassigned elsewhere in their public affairs office, and they just didn't have the manpower. So the fact that they had to, though, have an escort with me did somewhat limit when I could go, because if once or twice I wanted to attend things that they said, oh, we don't have anybody available who could work at that time. But in those instances, I was able to get cadets to actually escort me, and I just needed to have an escort. It didn't need to be a public affairs person. So in those instances, I was able to get cadets to escort, you know, to just kind of let me in, so to speak, and to keep an eye, you know, that I wasn't, I don't know what they would have been afraid of, but that I wasn't, you know, doing anything dangerous to the base itself. So it worked out in the end. It worked out just fine, and I was able to get, I thought, you know, a pretty valuable picture of an interesting place at a crucial moment in its history.
You focus specifically on one group, the Bulldogs of Squadron 13. How many cadets are we talking about in terms of that particular group?
There are 4,000 cadets at the academy, and 40 squadrons. So each one is roughly 100 cadets. Squadron 13 had about 110. It would depend on sort of when you checked, because some people leave the academy. Some people take time off to do missionary work, actually, occasionally. But it was between 100 and 110.
We get to know a few of them very, very well in your book. Is that a reflection on how certain cadets were more open to you, more open to speaking with you, or that certain cadets had especially compelling stories? Or did you just have to make the choice to focus on a few rather than all 110, which, of course, would have been a rather awkward challenge for you? But why is it that that the focus is where it is and on the particular cadets with whom you spend and we spend then a lot of time?
I felt that these cadets were representative of different kinds of cadets who show up each year, who turn up each year. One of them is a football jock who came from Georgia and was very reluctant, in a sense, to even be a cadet, but felt he didn't really have many other options. And another was a woman who had done junior ROTC in her high school and was really gung, had a very kind of troubled background and was really eager to have a sense of control over her future and was gung-ho and dying to get into a plane. And when I asked, you know, well, what exactly is it that you want to fly? Her answer was anything that shoots. So she was really gung-ho. And then there was one who was homeschooled, was the son of a rocket scientist, one of 10 children, and brought up with a very strong sort of Christian identity at home, which he brought with him to the academy, of course. And the fourth was a high school sort of a whiz kid from, well, I guess they all are kind of whiz kids. She was from California, and she had a very strong and supportive family who came with her, dropped her off at the academy, and her mom was really very kind of involved in the parents' clubs and had done was super proud, and they had done really everything they could to kind of ensure that this would be a very happy and positive experience for her. So I felt that these were four cadets, four personalities, in a sense, who were very representative of the kinds of cadets that turn up each year. So those were the dualies, as they're called. Dually is the term for a freshman, and it comes from the Greek word for doulos, which is slave. So that kind of gives you an idea of their status or lack of it that first year. But then also I wanted to focus somewhat on the upperclassmen, because for them this is their first opportunity at leadership, and that's in fact what the academy is all about. It's about producing leaders. And so I followed some of them to a lesser degree, because frankly the most intense experience is during that first year. That's when the most change is happening in terms of their lives. So it seemed to me the most compelling story. And then the leadership is a little bit, it's that's happening over 3 years. And so I talked to different cadets at different stages of their training in terms of leadership and get a sense of who they are and their history and where they're coming from. So I tried to provide a good balance between those who are immersed in learning about following orders and those who are sort of taking the reins for the first time and learning how to give orders.
That dynamic is one of the most interesting things we learn about in your book. I'm just curious, and I don't mean any criticism at all by the way I'm going to phrase this question, but was it apparent to the other dualies that, in a sense, you were playing favorites, that at some point in time, you know, these three or four freshmen became the most compelling figures and in whose stories you were especially interested and were going to lavish exceptional time in your and attention in your book? I mean, were you spending much more time with them, and would other classmates observing have been sort of cognizant of the fact that there are certain people whose stories are being followed very closely, and for instance, maybe mine isn't being followed at all? Do you know what I'm asking? And I'm just
I'm curious
because if that created any sense of, you know, perhaps awkwardness
of tension or I don't think it did, because they didn't really know what was going to come of the experience. They just knew that I was there, I was writing a book, and I was asking a lot of questions. And I wasn't actually focusing solely on the those four at the time of the reporting. In the reporting, I talked to other people as well, a lot of the reporting was also, in a sense, watching them going through. So I'm watching all of them going through recognition, for example, and basic training. While they're in the middle of this, in the midst of the training, which I spend quite a lot of time describing, I can't actually speak to them because I would get in the way, and I would be sort of I wouldn't be able to tell the story if I put myself in the middle of it.
Sure.
Able to hang back and watch.
And in a sense, you would have been changing the story, too.
Exactly.
And so altering their experience.
Exactly. So I had to, in a sense, make myself very small and just watch a lot. And then after some of these events, I would talk to cadets and, you know, try to get a sense of, well, what were you feeling? I saw you doing this. What was going on in your mind and your head when you were, you know? So then I was able to kind of reconstruct some sort of internal life to match what I was seeing externally. So that wouldn't make that so apparent, in a sense, because I was talking to a number of cadets. And then there were other cadets, like, I don't want to give away the story too much, but then there are other cadets who at some point just decided or couldn't speak. One of the cadets has a problem, and at first I'm not sure exactly what it is, but they say he's not allowed to speak. He's no longer a cadet in good standing. And so for a couple of months, we're not even speaking. We're sort of seeing each other, and I'm watching him, and I'm wondering what's going on. I'm asking around, and I'm sort of getting, like, bits and pieces of what the issue is. And then eventually, you know, we find out what had happened, and we kind of close the circle on his story and learn about what the experience was like for him. So that would also sort of mitigate that sense. I don't think it had that role. Although I will say that at one point, one of the cadets who was a 3 degree or a sophomore in civilian terms came up to me and said, "What does it take to be in your book?" And I said, "Well, why are you asking?" And he said, "Well, I just finished my instruction to be I just finished the course to be a pilot." Instructor, I'm going to be teaching other cadets how to fly. And I said, "Well, actually, that sounds pretty interesting. Let's talk." And he did end up in the book. For better or for worse, he ended up in the book. And he's part of the story. So wherever I saw something kind of interesting, I tried to get to it. But, you know, initially the book was supposed to run 100,000 words. And having been a newspaper reporter for over 25 years, I said, how am I ever going to write 100,000 words? You know, I was used to writing maybe 2,000 words for a really long story, but 100,000 was, wow, unimaginable. And by the time I finished, I had, like, written 120,000, and the editor, the publisher, was saying, "Not another word, not another word." And so I just ended up putting a lot of extra material that I had on a website, which I threw up, and there I put sort of background documents on profiles of cadets. I put a video. I put a bunch of other material that kind of fills out some of the story that I couldn't squeeze into 120,000 words.
One of the most important things which occurs when these cadets first arrive is the sort of breaking down of them as individuals, the shedding of what they have been and what they have possessed in order to, in a sense, be reshaped. At one point you said, as one watches this, it is though you are witnessing devastation and creation at once. Tell our listeners just one or two of the ways in which this happens with the newcomers to the Air Force Academy.
Well, when they first arrive, you know, they go into a bus, and the bus, they're saying goodbye to their parents, and the upperclassmen, the cadre who are supposed to train them, are very, very sweet and say, "Oh, say goodbye to your parents. They came all this way to say goodbye to you. So, you know, wave to your parents." And so it's kind of cute, actually, like all of these young people would sort of turn around, and they sheepishly wave to their parents and get on the bus. And as soon as the bus turns the corner and they're out of the sight of the parents, the upperclassmen come down on them like a ton of bricks and start shouting, raging at them, sit up straight, drop your hands, you know, wipe that smile off your face. And all of a sudden they're like thrown, they're hurled into this their new world. And in that new world, whatever they think or want to say is very strictly circumscribed. And it, in a sense, it tears down everything that they brought with them, everything. I mean, it's just if they want to say something, there are only certain formulas of ways that they can address the upperclassmen, especially during basic training. When they eat, they have to sit on the first third of their chair with their backs ramrod straight. They have to stare at the eagle, which is at the 12 o'clock position on their plates. They have to chew their food quickly. They have to reach for, they line up their glasses of juice and water and whatever in a certain sort of sequence, and they have to drink the clearer liquids first, and then, you know, I mean, their life is ordered to an unimaginable degree, and so that makes you question, in a sense, whatever you brought with you, because your head is suddenly so filled with what you must do right now that whatever was sort of in the back of your head just kind of gets crowded out. And so I think that's kind of an important way. The other thing they have to do is memorize enormous amounts of arcane facts that are all contained in a small book called Contrails. Theirs was red for their class color. And it has facts about Air Force history and Academy history, details about different kinds of planes, about insignias, all kinds of small things. And the cadets are tested on this stuff constantly and for any mistakes in answering the questions, of which they obviously will make many. They're dropped for push-ups and other sort of physical training exercises, and the term for that is that they're getting beat. So it's pretty crushing.
Yeah, it's a tough gauntlet. You write this at one point: the cadets have no firm idea what is coming. Their schedule is known to everyone but them. They receive no program and little warning beyond disconnected orders of what lies ahead. The purpose, of course, is to accustom them to follow orders unquestioningly, to rely on obedience rather than on individual judgment. The academy system is based on their becoming followers first, then leaders. And then you go on to give one relatively minor example of one such order. I think it's so interesting. For instance, today they are wearing two pairs of socks, white under black, but nobody has told them why. And the reason why is so that they can slowly break in their marching boots. And this is, it's just so intriguing. I mean, I think most of us live in situations where we want to know as much information as we can, and it's typically given fairly readily. But this is an arena in which the amount of information given is rather sparse, and it's for a purpose.
Mm-hmm. In that instance, yeah, it is. I mean, I think in another a day or so, I think after, or actually even later that day, I think where I make that observation, the cadets are all attending an assembly, and I ask one of them, well, what time do you think it is? And he said 9 o'clock, because they don't have any watches and they don't see clocks. I said 9 o'clock. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. And the sense of time is turned inside out completely, and so they're really disoriented. And that carries over, you know. Later on, I am attending some classes with upperclassmen where they're discussing the idea of collective punishment through Aristotle. It's a political philosophy class. And I was really surprised that, you know, this was a year that we had Abu Ghraib happening. We had, you know, extraordinary rendition was in the news. There were a lot of places where, you know, military or government were pushing the envelope. And in the case of Abu Ghraib, for example, you had at that stage, which was 06, 07, you had soldiers who were being called a few bad apples for mistreating the prisoners in Iraq. And we later came to learn that, in fact, some of those policies about how to treat them went very high up in the Pentagon. And so I found it really surprising that none of the discussion in the classroom touched on any of this. A discussion of collective punishment brought one question, which was, how would Aristotle feel about the idea of dropping all of the cadets in the unit for push-ups if one of them makes a mistake on a question? And the answer was, you'd be fine with it because you're there as a unit. But nobody said, well, how would you feel about, say, blowing up a house with civilians in it if we suspect that there are weapons in that house? Wherever you stand on the question isn't the point. The point is, it's a discussion that the future leaders of one of our military branches should be having, probably, at that stage. This is the place where they're learning to be leaders.
One of the really interesting sources of tension is when it comes to the matter of how these newcomers should be trained and by whom and by what means. And you talk at one point about, as they're entering a phase which I think is called the second beast, which I guess is part of basic training. Is that right?
Yes, that's sort of the boot camp side of it.
Right. And somebody who is a part of the leadership of this, Brandon Dewis, says he is buffeted by two antagonistic philosophies of training. The officers pushing for oversight, for more rational and humane treatment of the powerless newcomers, and the upper-class cadets arguing that cadre deserve freer rein to train these basics and that altering such long-standing tradition is a mistake. That's a really interesting picture. And one has a sense that there is something to be said for both sides of that divide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think you can sort of you can see both arguments because on the one hand, rationally, you would say, well, why do you need to train cadets? Why do you need to make it so much more like hazing? There are a lot of stupid things that go on. There was one group that their cadre sort of put them under hot water in the shower for 10 seconds, and then they, ordered them to go under cold water and then, shift to the next shower, cold water, and that's like straight-out hazing. There's no possible, reason for that. So there, it opens the way for excesses, and you can see the argument for, especially given, the abuses that were uncovered in the previous years, you could see the real argument for, cut that stuff out, and let's get a grip. But on the other hand, they are creating the future officers, and for them, they see it very much as a brotherhood. And part of part of that is owning the process, and in owning the process, what you also see some good things. It's not all about. It's not all about just driving people to excess. Some of it has to do with really caring about the training. Like, I was actually really touched by one cadet called Jamal Harrison, who took very seriously his charge to be training the next generation of officers, the younger ones after him. And it really got under his skin. He tried really hard during the year to help one cadet kind of boost him along when everybody else had no real hope for him. I mean, they were kind of riding this particular cadet really hard and saying, oh, he's just, a screw-off. He's just lazy. He's not, pulling his weight. And Jamal Harrison really worked hard to kind of believe in him and encourage him and help train him. And, he really cared about the quality of cadet that was coming up. And so I think you have to be also, I would be the last person on earth to make an argument for hazing, but I think, you do have to, in changing the policies, you do have to make sure that you have buy-in from the upperclassmen, because you don't want to lose that. You don't want to lose that sense of ownership and that sense that they really care about what they're doing.
One interesting statement about this comes from someone we won't name, who ultimately ends up leaving the Air Force Academy. He leaves at winter break, and unbeknownst to, I think, most of his classmates, he actually has set the wheels in motion to not return. And he is unhappy there. And one of the reasons for this particular young man is because he had gone to some sort of Air Force Academy prep school where, in your words, the training had been tough, but it was done entirely by enlisted officers, so it had seemed more professional and rational. There was nothing gratuitous in its harshness. Despite the new layers of oversight, training at the Air Force Academy was still mostly run by older cadets, so it sometimes felt more arbitrary, even cruel. It's so interesting to think about because, on the one hand, it may in fact have been that. I mean, almost certainly there would be instances in which somebody sort of gets a bit drunk with their own power and so on. But
on
the other hand,
I think toward the end of the story, I don't want to give away too much of it, but toward the end, we see two of the characters actually interacting where that becomes the issue.
Right.
The issue. And I actually only learn about it afterward because, I don't want to give away the story, but it's like, sort of like the next to the last chapter or something, and it really becomes the issue, this getting drunk with power and the tendency to almost allow anything. It's a clash between an upperclassman and a freshman. And in that power equation, both of them are sort of considered outsiders. They both don't quite fit the mold. But in that kind of an equation, the one who is the upperclassman wins. Hmm. And the one who is vulnerable just for being a freshman and an outcast in that kind of a clash with an upperclassman really loses in a big way. I mean, all of the presumptions are against the younger one.
Right. And yet what's interesting about the young man who I quoted is that also, in certain cases, this is also probably a matter of perception, that this harsh treatment, or what feels harsh and unpleasant in the moment, it's one thing when that comes from an enlisted officer, but when it's from a fellow student, an upperclassman, granted, but there are many situations where even when it's entirely for laudable reasons and so on, that still doesn't feel the same when it's coming from a fellow student. I thought that was really interesting, too, because I think he has his finger on what makes it a very, very tricky relationship and situation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the people who are doing the training are maybe 1 or 2 years older, in extreme cases maybe 3 years older than the people they're training. So it's sort of like maybe they have a brother or a sister at home. You know, it's kind of like your sister suddenly becoming your mother, maybe, or more like your brother becoming your father, you know. So it is kind of, I think that is part of the dynamic. But, you know, in a sense, they're entering a universe, these dualies enter a universe where they're completely outnumbered. And so it's, in a sense, however you feel about it when you go in, it's almost like sort of challengeable. And I think that was part of the issue for this cadet who ultimately left, and felt, I think he felt that the whole process was just, in a sense, for him, corrupt. He felt that a lot of it was corrupt.
And of course, others managed to survive and even even thrive in this experience. I don't want to let you go without us making at least brief mention of something else which made this scenario.
Can I just interject something for a second?
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention, the funny thing, this cadet was roommates with, he was roommate with the football player. They were both football players. They both went to the prep school, and they both ended up rooming together in Squadron 13. And his roommate, who did stay, by the end of it, in the epilogue, I asked him, about know, first year, his difficult first year and everything, he stayed. He was on track to become a pilot. And he said, a lot of the things I didn't see reasons for at the time, I see the reasons for now. Hmm. So it's also possible that, you know, these are two people who were on the same track. One went one way, one went the other way. And it's possible that if that fellow had stayed and not gone, he might have felt, you know, two or three years down the line, like, oh, now I see why it made sense to do it that way.
Sure. You quote him as saying this, I guess it's like a process. Freshman year, they cut you down, and then after that, in sophomore and junior year, they build you up again. I was never there for the build you up part. I mean, in a sense, he didn't survive long enough to experience that.
Exactly, exactly.
One other thing which complicates this situation, I do want us to at least make brief mention of it before we close, is that a few of the incoming freshmen made a very, very bad mistake via the social computer network known as MySpace. Tell our listeners what some of these incoming new cadets did.
Yeah, they made probably the worst mistake they could make. They went on MySpace, they formed a kind of informal group, and started ragging on the upperclassmen who were about to train them. Because of the sexual assault scandal in 2003, for 2 years the academy suspended the spring training exercise called Recognition, which they had done. Recognition was something every class had experienced since the first class of the academy until that moment. And it's a very, very difficult. It's sort of like basic training on steroids. It's really difficult and goes on for two days, very intense. And at the end of it, these freshmen who have gone through their first year, basically being, abused, not in the strict legal sense, but kind of in the sense of being talked down to and being shouted at and having to meet all kinds of crazy arcane rules, they suddenly are accepted as cadets in full standing, and they can address the upperclassmen in any, by their first name. They can, they're human, basically. They become accepted as equals. So these two classes had never experienced that, and the class of 07 and 08 had never experienced that, and they were the ones who were going to be doing the training for the new kids coming in. And so the new cadets coming in went on MySpace, and they started bad-mouthing and trash-talking the cadets who were going to be training them and saying, you know, what makes them strong enough to train us? Ha-ha, we're going to, they didn't even go through Recognition, and who are they, and they're probably weak, and not exactly what you want to be saying to the people who are going to have your life in their hands for the next 6 weeks. And so they did have to, they met with the ire of the upperclassmen over that, even as they were getting into the bus. I wasn't aware of this initially. I had sort of seen some stuff on MySpace, but I wasn't aware of what a raw nerve it hit. But as the first cadets were getting into the bus, leaving their parents, the upperclassmen were kind of checking their faces to see if any of them matched, and their tags to see if any of them matched the names and the faces from the MySpace group.
Reason number 1,000 to be careful when you use things like Facebook and MySpace.
Exactly.
Well,
very expensive lesson for them.
Absolutely. Well, the stories are so powerful and meaningful and poignant, stories both of success and of failure, of graduation and withdrawal, and many of the stories do not unfold quite as we would expect them to. And that, of course, is the beauty of real life as well, especially when it is captured in all of its complexity. The book, again, is called Skies to Conquer, A Year Inside the Air Force Academy, complete with photographs. It is published by Wiley, and the author, Diana Jean Schemmel. Diana Dean Schemmel, I enjoyed this book so much, and I'm really grateful that we could have this long conversation about your fascinating book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been delightful.